Good morning and welcome to this December 17th, 2014 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. It is my pleasure to welcome Asaf Gavron to the show this morning, and coming up in the second half hour, Chris Beatty, the man who started National Novel Writing Month, NaNoWriMo, which just happened this past November, will be here to discuss his book, No Plot, No Problem. If you've ever tried NaNoWriMo, or if you've wanted to, or you never intend to, but you just want his writing advice, stick around for that interview. But first, Asaf Gavron has published five novels, Ice, Moving, Almost Dead, Hydromania, and most recently, The Hilltop, a collection of short stories, Sex in the Cemetery, and a nonfiction collection of Jerusalem falafel joint reviews, Eating Standing Up. His fiction has been translated into numerous languages, adapted for stage, and has won countless awards. As a translator of fiction, Asaf has been responsible for the highly regarded English to Hebrew translations of J.D. Salinger's Nine Stories, Philip Roth's Portnoy's Complaint, and Jonathan Safran Foer's novels, among others. He has written computer games, journalistic pieces. He is a singer and main songwriter of the cult group The Foot and Mouth. He is the son of English immigrants growing up in a small village near Jerusalem and currently lives in Omaha, Nebraska, where he teaches literature and creative writing at the University of Nebraska in Omaha. In addition to his latest novel, The Hilltop, we're going to talk craft and inspiration and translation and story swapping, all the things writing related. Asaf, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming on. I'm intrigued by this move from move to Omaha from, you know, Berlin and London and Tel Aviv and all these other big international cities now to Omaha. Just by way of introduction, just talk about what brought you there.
Well, I got an offer to teach. For me, I see Israel as my home, especially Tel Aviv, which became my home maybe 15 years ago. But it's a home base that I need to get out from once in a while. It's a little bit intense. So when I have the opportunity, I leave. So I lived a few years in London, UK, and 1 year in Berlin. And I was kind of looking for another opportunity, and this one came up. And first, I wasn't sure. I didn't know a lot about Omaha or about Nebraska. But then, you know, I thought a bit also with my family, and we decided it would be an interesting adventure. So we're here in the U.S.
I can give Omaha a bad time because my husband's from Omaha, and having been there, I haven't been to Tel Aviv, but I can't imagine two more different parts of the world. That's great. That's great.
Yes, they're very, very different. It takes some time to adjust to, and I think I'm beginning to adjust, although it's a bit cold.
It's probably a good, I don't know if anecdote is the right word, but it's probably great for a writer because you're, you know, experiencing such a different, it's such a step out of, you know, your normal place of life that
gives
you perspective.
Yes, it is. And although I do tend to write about Israel, about the situation, the political reality of Israel, I also like to explore other places. And I did write actually a story, the novel Moving that you mentioned is does take place in the U.S., but actually the funny thing is that I did have an idea for a Midwestern novel a long time ago. I kind of always stayed in the back of my mind, and then now I got this opportunity, so I'm actually experiencing Midwest life. And you're right, it's great to like open your mind and to see other ways of living.
Right. So on that note, I'm going to let you talk about The Hilltop, sort of take us into, you've described this as your most ambitious novel. And for listeners who haven't yet picked it up, talk about the world and kind of what inspired this world and what motivated you to take on this ambitious project.
Okay, so it's based in the West Bank, in a settlement, a small illegal settlement in the West Bank. The settlements in the West Bank, just quick introduction. I have been probably the center of the conflict in the Middle East, or the main point of contention between Israelis and Palestinians, and Israel and the U.S., and among Israelis themselves. The gist of the argument is the supporters of the settlement say this has been part of the land of Israel, promised by God, and Jews have been settling in the area for thousands of years. The opposers say that it's not really officially a part of Israel. It's been occupied in a war in 67. The international law does not recognize it as part of Israel. And more than anything, there are 3 million Palestinians living there. So, without a state of their own and without clear rights. So, it's a huge. It's probably the biggest obstacle to peace at the moment. And for me, the settlers and the way of life and what they do there, I find it fascinating as a writer. Without going into the politics of whether I'm for or against, it's this kind of a frontier way of life, you know. It's a kind of a new Western. These people are claiming lands, are living in very basic conditions in this middle of a violent region, lots of tensions. So the book is basically a year in the life of such a settlement, how it came to be, and it's under threat of evacuation by the authorities. But those same authorities that are threatening to evacuate are also, other parts of it are helping them. I mean, it's a constant, like, cat and mouse chase where the settlers are trying to grab as much as they can. And the story does about this group of people, about 12 trailers, families living there, their relations among themselves, and also with the outside world, with the army, with the government, with the Palestinians, with the media. So that's basically it. And specifically, it tells, it goes into detail into the lives of two brothers who are there in the settlement, and the story goes back to their childhood in a kibbutz in the north of Israel, and following their very separate journeys through life until they get to that settlement through Tel Aviv, and also part in partly in America. So that's more or less the story.
Yeah. You've talked about this really lovely contradiction among the Israeli people of being so connected to this land for 3,000 years and yet continuously searching for themselves, kind of wandering the earth, searching for their identity. And I think that's such a fascinating and unique to Israel plight.
Yeah, and you know, there is this term, the Jewish wanderer or the wandering Jew, and we have been kind of, you know, traveling around the earth, whether by force, you know, having been thrown out of places or driven out of places, or by choice of exploring. And you know, there are Jews everywhere. Even in Omaha, there's quite a decent size community that I've met recently. And also, although we've kind of reached our peace and quiet in founding a land, founding a state of Israel 67 years ago, it still didn't stop this wandering, and many young Israelis are still, you know, not sure where their true place is, and are still wandering around the world and searching for basically for their identity, for their place in life.
So you spent quite a bit of time at the settlements. It sounded like you went in once or twice a week to the settlements for a year or so while you were writing the book. Talk a little bit about being there, how welcomed you were as writer there, I assumed people knew that you were working on a novel, and sort of translating that experience a little bit to fiction, how much of your experience is, you know, sort of direct details from living it?
Yes, I first of all, I did not grow up as a settler or as a religious Jew. Those words are quite foreign to me. I grew up near Jerusalem, as you said, and lived most of my life in Tel Aviv, which is not very far away, because it's already small. It's only about a 1 hour drive away, but it's different worlds completely. And I needed to research once I decided that this subject is interesting for me, for a novel. And I traveled for 2 years all over the West Bank. The West Bank is very varied. There are very different types of settlers and settlements. The north of it, the part that is called Samaria, is more hardcore, more ideological. There I found it harder to connect to people and not very welcomed. I was even being asked politely or not so politely to leave when I arrived, when they realized what I was there for. But other parts of the West Bank, and specifically the part south of Jerusalem, Judea, which is on the edge of the desert, is more moderate and more welcoming, and there I've you know, made some friends, and specifically in this one small settlement, Koad D, about 15 miles from Jerusalem. That's the one I kept returning to. And yeah, the people, you know, anyone who asked me, I told them what I was there for. They didn't interfere. They were actually quite curious about this Tel Avivi guy, the writer, coming and asking questions and finding out how they are living. And they actually invited me a few months ago to do a talk there after the book was published, and it was a very interesting evening. So I went over there. I stayed in some of the places. I sucked in the atmosphere, talked to the people. I believe as a writer, I believe in research. I believe that if I'm writing about a world that is initially foreign to me, I really need to learn the material and to understand what I'm talking about. And if I can convince myself that I know what I'm writing about, then I can convince the readers.
Right. My guest this morning is Asaf Gavron. The book is The Hilltop. A few weeks back on the show, we were talking, I was talking with Azar Nafisi about what constitutes American fiction, what's unique about American fiction versus, in that case, Iranian fiction. And I was wondering, is there in your mind a notion of what constitutes Israeli fiction, separate and apart from the politics of the region, or even being set in the region? Is there something unique about Israeli writers that you could identify, regardless of knowing even the subject matter of the book, you know, that there's some Israeli identity that comes through in their fiction?
I think so. I mean, of course, you cannot generalize, and many Israeli writers would oppose such attempt to generalize Israeli fiction, and even oppose dealing too much with the political side of things. It's like, why do we have to write only about, you know, what people expect us to write, which is the war and the conflict with the Palestinians, and why aren't we allowed to write just whatever, a love story, a family story, and so on? Right. But having said that, I do think that we do have, first of all, a special situation, you know, a tense, a conflict situation. We have been experiencing wars over the years, and it's not, you know, it's not Luxembourg. It's this place that is under constant threat and in a very special circumstances. And also, the other thing is that we draw on a long tradition, although we are a very young state, of 67 years, we draw on a very long Jewish tradition of culture and of creativity and of literature, which is you know, it's a little difficult to pinpoint and identify exactly what that means, but I think it has a lot of humor, it has a lot of compassion, and it has this sense of being this unique tribe, you know, that is existing constantly throughout history, and has contributed a lot, maybe more than its relative size, to different parts of living, culture, and so on.
Yeah, indeed. You have talked about the scope and structure of this novel being influenced by Jonathan Franzen's Freedom, and I wanted you to talk about that a little bit, about how that novel became an inspiration for you and how it served as perhaps a template, I don't know the word you'd give to it, and what the two novels might have in common in your mind.
Well, I'm a big fan of Franzen, starting from The Corrections and then reading back to earlier books. And when Freedom came out, it was after I started working on The Hilltop, but it kind of gave me a goal or a signpost. I thought it was an incredible novel. By coincidence, I started working with Franzen's agent, so we share an agent, and I just thought that there was something, although he's dealing with American life and with U.S. politics, there's something about the structure and the scope, about zooming in into the lives of a specific family, but then looking at it from different aspects that are bigger, that have to do with for example, American foreign policy, whether it's in South America or Eastern Europe in the case of The Corrections, and also with even bigger issues doing with nature. In Freedom, it's the case of those birds and the environmental thing, and also the world population explosion. So he kind of drifts in and out from big political issues and into the personal stories of people, and on the personal level searching for identity and family relations, and he manages to kind of weave everything together into one coherent story novel, which is both very emotional and also thought-provoking, you know, deals with the big questions of life, and also finally funny. You know, he has this wonderful humor. No one would describe Franzen as a comic writer, but I think there's a lot of comedy in the specific, you know, life situations that his characters tackle. So, you know, it's a big mountain to climb for me, and I wouldn't claim to be as good as him. It's probably as good as it gets in terms of contemporary writers, in my opinion. But in terms of trying to achieve that, I think it was my ambition. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can see it throughout that. That's true. My guest this morning is Asaf Gavran. The book is The Hilltop. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Before, I'd love to listen to just a couple of minutes of the novel. Before we do that, when we were talking about you living in Omaha, I got to thinking about living on the outside versus the inside of a novel. And I read that you wrote part of this novel while living in Berlin. So I was hoping you could talk about inhabiting one culture diverse from your own while writing about another, and if there were any advantages to living in Germany that contributed to this novel in a way it would have lacked if it had been written entirely in Israel?
I think it contributed. It wasn't planned. I won this grant to live in Germany for 1 year and to write. And it was in the middle. At first, I was a little bit kind of worried, you know, that I'm getting far away from my material. But eventually, I mean, afterwards, I was thankful for this year because, as I said in the very beginning, in the first question, it's very tense to live in Israel. It surrounds you all the time. You're in the news. You're constantly thinking and sometimes more than thinking. You know, in the last summer we were in Tel Aviv and missiles were or rockets were falling or at least shot towards Tel Aviv every day for almost 2 months. And getting away from that and breathing, you know, the cooler European air kind of gave me a perspective, I think, to relax a bit and to write about it from the outside without having to travel every week to the West Bank and so on. So I'm really thankful for that opportunity. And further than that, you mentioned the inspirations of the culture surrounding you. I felt that in Berlin, and even more so in London when I lived there, and I also wrote there for a while, or some of my previous books, you know, I love this European culture, this different, very different from the Israeli, which is again all the time steeped in this situation, in the ongoing conflicts and violence and so on. So I think it helped me a lot to be somewhere else, as it is now in Omaha, to see other things, to live a different life.
Right, right. I also want to hit on your work in translation, because it strikes me as such a powerful tool for a writer to speak different languages, and to be able to be steeped in the work of translation, finding the not only the right word, but the right tone, the right emotional tone to convey something in a different language with all of the idioms and cultural references and all of that. So talk about if there are things from your life as translator that translate to your work as fiction writer.
Yeah, I never went I never learned how to write. I didn't go to a creative writing school or class. So for me, I see my work as a translator as my lessons in writing. Because as a translator, you get so deep into a text, you read it again and again and again, even more than the writer itself in some cases, and you understand the bones and structures of how fiction works, and you also see the little faults and mistakes. So for me, it still is a lesson in how to write, what you should do and what you shouldn't do. In most of the books that I've translated, I learned over time, you know, those faults and those little mistakes, and I guess I kind of learned maybe to less respect those books. But there were two cases that every time I read, I reread and retranslated and rewrote it, I respected those writers and those books more. And those were J.D. Salinger, Nine Stories, and Philip Roth, Portnoy's Complaint. And those just, you know, wonderful books. So it wasn't like lesson, do this, do that. But I think that by rewriting those books and actually writing them from scratch in a different language, I think I learned a lot.
Yeah. On that note, can you read to us for just a couple of minutes, and then our listeners will know how great The Hilltop is.
Okay, I'll read the first page. From the prologue. The most of the book takes place in the settlement during 1 year, but the prologue goes back to about 5 years or 4 years earlier, when this settlement was actually founded. So I'll read only the first page. It's called The Fields. In the beginning were the fields. Back then, Otniel Assis was living in Maale Chermesh, merrily raising a goat and growing arugula and cherry tomatoes in his backyard. The goat was for his kids, the arugula and tomatoes for his wife Rachel's salads. And Otniel saw that it was good, and he tired of his job as a bookkeeper, and he found himself a small plot of land within the bounds of the settlement on which to expand his crops. As fate would have it, however, the field bordered on the vineyards of another settler, whose grapes produced boutique wines that were sold to his Golden Apple restaurant and other fine dining establishments, including, the vintner claimed, several in the Dordogne region of France, and in Paris too. And the vintner turned up his nose, declaring that he had received a permit from the regional council to plant additional vineyards on the very plot of land that had caught Otniel's fancy. The soil, he insisted, along with the cold winters and the temperate summer nights, had imbued his grapes with an outstanding quality, a unique terroir, which produced a full-bodied wine with a nutty aroma. And so it came to pass that Otniel deferred to the vintner and went out hiking through the surrounding land, for he deeply loved his country, and deeply loved solitude, and deeply loved to pray, and deeply loved to walk. Having left his job, he allowed his beard and hair to grow long, and wore only blue work clothes. He hiked through riverbeds and ravines, and across neighboring hilltops, until he came upon a wide open plain, which wasn't particularly rocky, and wasn't already occupied by the olive trees of the neighboring Arab village of Charmish. Here, he said, I will stake out my fields.
Fantastic.
That's it.
That was Asaf Gavron reading from The Hilltop, out and available in the U.S. now. We're drawing down on our time, but I wanted to give you a chance to share any writing advice over the course of novels, a nonfiction book, a short story collection. Most of our listeners are writers themselves. Can you share any advice you have found useful along the way?
Yes. I'll say two things. One is write every day. I know that many people say it, but for me it's crucial. You know, if I have the choice of having 1 hour every day or having 2 full days a week, I'll go for the 1 hour every day. I think that it's very important to stay connected to the story and to the writing, and not to lose touch, and to write through the whole draft every day of the week, including the weekends. That works for me. My other advice would be one that I myself heard from a great writer, Carol Shields, a writer who passed away a few years ago, but I interviewed her maybe 10 years ago when she published a book for an Israeli newspaper, and I asked her the same question, you know, can you give me a tip? And the one thing she told me is write about work. Mm. Write about jobs. You know, there are people sometimes forget, writers sometimes forget, you know, to give enough emphasis, enough importance to the daily jobs of people. But this is, you know, what people connect to, because this is what people do every day, probably spending most of the hours of the day in their work. And for me, since then, it became an important idea, you know, to give my characters a job, and to learn about this job, and to follow through their work lives. I think that was a wonderful tip, and I'm happy to share it along.
That is one I haven't heard recently, and that is a great insight. Asaf Gavron, thank you so much for taking the time this morning. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
You can find Asaf online. He has a wonderful website, asafgavran.com. There are amazing interviews up there with him. And he is involved in a project I hadn't heard of before called Narrative 4, where people share a personal story with each other, and then they retell the other person's story as a way of garnering empathy, stepping into somebody else's shoes. What a great, great project. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Chris Beatty will be here for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows. We are on Facebook, Writers on Writing, KUCI. FM. We are on Twitter, although I know nothing about Twitter. I hear we're on Twitter, and we're on Stitcher. You can follow us a dozen different ways. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. I'm your guest host for the hour. Onward with the show. I'm joined now by Chris Beatty. Chris accidentally founded National Novel Writing Month in 1999 and oversaw the event's growth from 21 friends to more than 300,000 writers in 90 countries. Chris now serves as a board member emeritus for NaNoWriMo and spends his days teaching classes at Stanford University's Writer Studio, giving talks about writing and creativity, helping companies with content strategy, and endlessly revising his own novels. He's the author of No Plot, No Problem, the co-author of Ready, Set, Novel, and the maker of Fine Posters. We'll talk about all of that and that more this morning. Chris, hi.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you for coming on. What a huge pleasure. I kept telling friends, lots of friends who have participated in NaNoWriMo, that you were coming on this morning, and there's a lot of excitement. People want to hear all about this.
Oh, good. They're not angry at me for taking away their Novembers or anything.
No, they are grateful to you. They're grateful to you. So take us back to the origins of NaNoWriMo, how this got started, what these 21 friends were talking about when this all got off the ground.
Yeah, so yeah, this was 16 years ago, which doesn't seem possible to me, but I guess I was doing the math. I was 26, and you know, I am somebody that comes up with a lot of kind of wacky and clearly bad ideas, and the idea for writing 50,000 word novels in a month was definitely ranks among among the strangest and probably on paper worst ideas that I had come up with. But I just pitched it to friends via email, and I got 20 yeses, which was amazing. And I had set this somewhat arbitrary 50,000 word goal just by kind of trying to find the shortest novel on my bookshelf that could still be considered a legitimate novel. And so, and then we were off. And none of us, I think, really, all of us loved books and reading, and we, you know, had this amazing reverence for authors, but none of us, I think, saw this as our path to literary superstardom, or, you know, even, you know, a likely path to writing a good book. I think we just kind of liked the challenge of it, and a chance to kind of drink too much coffee and spend time making something and exploring our imaginations. And it ended up being a surprising success that, you know, none of us, I think, wrote great books, but I think we wrote sort of reasonably unhorrible books. And that was, to me, a revelation. And I thought, all right, if we can do this, anybody can do this. And that was kind of the start of this annual event.
Okay, so you're being very modest, which is very sweet. But clearly this is connected to, well, you know, 300,000 people in 90 countries and growing. So what do you think it is from this, you know, this terrible idea that you had that clearly was a brilliant idea? What is it that connected to everybody?
I mean, I think the magic in it is kind of approaching this very daunting creative project with two things. One is a sense of community. You know, I think we think of writing typically as something you do on your own. And I think there's a real magic, especially around first drafts, in having this sense that, okay, it's from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., five nights a week, I'm going to have a group of friends waiting for me at the coffee shop. And that's huge. I think having a sense of accountability that brings is great. The other thing, along with the community, is this terrifying deadline. I mean, yeah. I just think that impossible deadlines are somehow easier to hit than merely difficult ones. And there's something in this idea of committing to writing so much so quickly that I think helped all of us prioritize the project, because you can't not. You know, it's like you have this 1,667 daily word count goal, and if you miss it for a couple days, that amount of word debt really starts to weigh on your soul. So that kind of compels you to be like, okay, I'm not going to take time off. I'm going to try to do this every day. And, you know, for you and other writers, you know that the magic is in the momentum, right? If you're coming to the page every day, your characters are becoming more alive and interesting. You're connected to the guts of the thing in the way that you never are if you just try to parachute in every weekend and kind of try to remember who are these people again? And
right.
So I think that was it, is really this sense of companionship, a little bit of sense of fun. But the deadline is huge, you know, and unfortunately we so rarely get these terrifyingly motivating deadlines in places where we need them, like, you know, music or art or writing, and we get a whole bunch of them in places where we don't want them, like work. So I think bringing a deadline to creativity is just really a useful thing.
Yeah. So tell us, first of all, how did it become to be November?
So it started in July, and the next year rolled around, and I was like, all right, who wants to do this again? And everybody was like, I'm going to be in Mexico. I'm in New York. So I was like, all right, how about let's do August? And August didn't pan out. And we just kept rolling through the calendar until finally we found the first month that all that original crew that wanted to come back and do it again could do it. And so November, I think, is actually probably, for those of us in the Northern Hemisphere, is better than July, because the weather tends to be pretty miserable for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Very conducive to writing. But I think also just it doesn't have that summer vacation. The downside, of course, for people in the United States is Thanksgiving. And there's a whole set of strategies and tools for managing your Thanksgiving survival plan.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, I know. I was thinking this is a great excuse to get out of a lot of uncomfortable dinners. You can just...
It's so good. Well, so the line that you use, and I give this to everybody who's going to be doing this next year, is you say, I'm a finalist in a national novel writing competition, and they are expecting my manuscript on November 30th. And that, I think, opens the door to a lot of you not needing to cook anything. You don't have to linger as long at the table. You can type while people are talking. A lot of bad behavior is excused by finalists in national novel writing competition.
Brilliant. Brilliant. And you can sit there and transcribe their dialogue after they've gotten drunk and they're spilling family secrets. So you just use that as your 2,000 words for the day, right?
Three words, exactly. Yeah, just have that that phone recording every bit of dialogue that comes out of their mouths. I love it.
Right, right. So let's talk about some of the success stories that have come out of this. Night Circus, I know, was a book that was on the show a couple of years ago that was a national novel writing book. Tell us about your big successes.
Yeah, well, so, and we've had this really wonderful, wonderful growing number of people who have started taking this 50,000-word beginning, because really, you know, National Novel Writing Month should be called, you know, National First Draft of a Novel Writing Month, and what, at the end of the month, what you really have is kind of a really promising start. Some people get an entire arc out, some people just write the first 50,000 words and then keep rolling through December and January, so... we've had a lot of people who have really used this seed and grown it into something great. So Night Circus by Aaron Morgenstern is really well known. Water for Elephants by Sarah Gruen. In fact, I think all but one of Sarah's novels have National Novel Writing Month as their, you know, that's the origin of those books. Wool by Hugh Howe is another one. Rainbow Rowell's great YA book, Fangirl. Is another one. There, it's really, I never would have dreamed when this started, you know, that it would become something where, you know, when I go to a bookstore now, it's hard not to see National Novel Writing Month books there, which is just so wonderful. And I think really inspiring, too, a lot of stories, you know, I think of stories like Lonnie Diane Rich, who has, I think, gone on to publish maybe three or four of her NaNoWriMo novels, but she'd never finished a novel, always wanted to, saw the website, you know, signed up at midnight on Halloween, and, you know, and then ended up writing this book that really surprised her, and she sold it in a two-book deal to Warner Books, and that really just began this writing career. And we've had a whole bunch of people that are like that, people that didn't see themselves as novelists but really loved books, thought, I'm going to give this a shot, and now are writing for a living, which is just so wonderful.
That is great. So what do you need before you begin? How much do you need to know? Do you need to know anything? Because you say no plot, it doesn't matter. Do you need an idea for a character or, I don't know, anything? Do you need anything?
I think it depends on your personality. And kind of in my experience, the world sort of divides neatly into people that really love to plan their books, and that's part of the joy for them is, you know, this beautiful outline, and they kind of do character explorations where they might cast actors as certain characters and make collages and really think about it for months leading up to the first draft. And if that is appealing to you, do it. Go crazy. You know, do plot outlines. You know, go do live action studies where you kind of like go to places where your character might work and take notes and really make it an adventure, the sort of planning process. But you can also just wing it. And if you are somebody that tends to like that more improvisational style of doing things, if you are somebody that does not pack for trips until maybe you're on the way to the airport for that trip, that is a totally viable approach. And in fact, you know, there are a lot of great, great writers who really just kind of like to discover the book as they write it. You know, they want to be surprised as well. And I think typically what people end up using is some hybrid of those two, where they, for me, I tend to start planning maybe a week or two out. I try to get a scenario that might be interesting, a set of characters, and I start thinking about maybe what the conflicts are. But it's totally up to you. And the nice thing about National Novel Writing Month is it comes around every year, and so you can kind of experiment with different techniques. So maybe you try just winging it, just diving in and seeing how it goes. If that was a disaster, next November you can really work on that outline.
That's great. That's great. My guest this morning is Chris Beatty. The book No Plot, No Problem. Chris started National Novel Writing Month that takes place in November, NaNoWriMo. And you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. If you aren't doing the formal NaNoWriMo, you can still use this book as, you know, I think books come out in similar ways, whether it's 30 days or 10 years, I suppose. So the book is full, I will tell our listeners, of really wonderful practical advice of how to stay motivated, how to talk yourself out of the back of your closet, which I think all writers need. So tell us a couple of the tips and tricks in here. If you don't have a deadline, you're right, deadlines work so incredibly well. And do you use artificial deadlines throughout the rest of the year to keep yourself motivated?
Constantly. You need them. I mean, I think the revision process needs them just as much as that first creative burst because, you know, to me, writing is as much an act of project management as it is an act of creativity. I just think, you know, we have a million things going on in our lives. We have a million commitments that are non-negotiable. You know, that might be to work or to family. And so getting anything done that's really just kind of for you, which I think for a lot of people, these novels really are just kind of these personal projects. It's just a chance to kind of spend time in creative play and really revel in that sense of like, wow, there's a lot going on in my brain that I didn't realize was there. Yeah. But I think that unless you have a calendar and you have a kind of a routine, it's just not going to get done. No matter how much you are committed to it, how much you really want this to happen, I think schedules are essential for getting these things done, because there will always be something that's going to pop up that is like, okay, you need to pick your kid up from school, you need to go grocery shopping. I mean, these just basics of life. But I think it helps if you know ahead of time, Thursday from whatever, from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m., I write, that's my writing time. You can protect that a little more easily, and you can kind of plan around it. So absolutely, year-round deadlines, as unsexy as that sounds, really will help you get things done.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, one thing that struck me as really true about this book is the beginning is very, as you say, you know, trumpets blaring and angels singing and everything's very exciting at the beginning. And then there's this horrible trough that during the month happens in like week two or three. In normal course of writing might happen in year four or five, whenever it comes about. So getting yourself through the trough, talk a little bit about that, because I know so many writers right now who are stuck in the trough. And
yeah, well, everybody gets there, you know, and that's a sign you're making progress, right? That you've moved out of your safe comfort zone. I think of like the first chapter of the novel is sort of like the front porch of your house where, you know, it's great. You got your snacks, you got your drinks, you're playing your tunes. Life is good. You know that area. But I think you need to wander into the wilderness a little bit in order to create something memorable and unique and to really kind of push past this sort of safe area. You know, a lot of people, I think, get caught up in just revising the first chapter of their novel over and
yes.
over and over again, because yes. it feels great. You know, it's like, oh, I know these people, I know the situation, I'm making it better. But you really do have to get lost in order to find this book. And so I really just sort of, when people are saying, I hate my book, I hate these people, I'm so bored with this, I'm lost, I just say, that's great. Keep going. You know, every book that has inspired you to write, every book you've loved, that author has traversed the exact same thing, had that exact same thing happen where they just thought, this is awful. And one of the great things in National Novel Writing Month is we get great writers, Sue Grafton, Neil Gaiman, you know, Dave Eggers, Nick Hornby, Amy Bender, all these great writers, to send out pep talks to writers saying basically, like, keep going, and sharing kind of their struggles with that. And when we are writing novels for the first time, I think we just assume it's us, our problem. It's that the idea is bad, or that we don't have enough skills. But in fact, it's just a novel is unlike anything else. It's this massive world that we're kind of wandering through and kind of trying to find a path through. And you hit dead ends and you double back and you hit another dead end. But as long as you keep going, you'll find your way out. But I think it's just so important to know that it's not always going to be that beautiful heavenly choir, you know, that
right.
is sort of singing at the beginning of the book. That in fact, that choir is going to get bored or lost or kidnapped along the way. And you're going to have to keep going even when it feels like, oh, I'm just making this worse. You're not making it worse. As long as you're moving forward, you're doing good.
Yeah, the Night Circus story really resonated with me. Aaron's story really resonated with me because it took so many passes at that novel. I mean, like 6 or 7 or, I don't know, 10. It was arduous, where she was throwing it out and starting over again and really coming at it almost brand new. I don't know how many times she ran that novel through NaNoWriMo, but
I think it was 3. She maybe 3 or 4. Yeah, it's amazing. And that's so common. You know, I love listening to interviews with authors. And I remember hearing an interview with David Mitchell, you know, who wrote Cloud Atlas and all these other, you know, exquisitely crafted books. And he was talking about The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet. And he was saying that he just hit a point with it where he knew things weren't working. He ended up cutting 75,000 words of revised text out of that book. And that's a sign that there was just something, that something had gotten really off. And this is a man that I think really understands the guts of storytelling and prose structuring. And even he gets lost and confused, and it's just a struggle, but I think it's one of the most beautiful struggles on earth. So, you know, there's a real reward to getting it through, but it's so important to just have faith that as long as you keep going, you will get there, because otherwise you tend to lose momentum and there are all these other things that are calling for our attention. So, yeah.
Right, right. My guest this morning is Chris Beatty, the book No Plot, No Problem. We're talking about National Novel Writing Month, NaNoWriMo, on Writers on Writing. One of the things that was heartening to me is that a lot of writers come to writing because they already have good taste. They already have a good ear. And it's and that the more passes through you take in just doing writing, the better you get. And I was thinking, why is that true? Because when you are learning to play the piano or exercise, any of the other analogies that I often give to writing as something hard, if you practice it wrong, you embed all of these bad practices into your brain. But writing seems different. For some reason, you can write alone, and if you just keep doing it, you just get better at it, even maybe without a teacher or an MFA program. And I was wondering if you had any insight into why that's true.
That's such a fascinating question, right? This idea of practice. And, you know, I think the analogy to music lessons is an interesting one. And I think about, you know, I'm a horrible but very enthusiastic guitarist. You know, I just love playing, you know, and I can't do a lot with it. But and I think about when I first started that guitar and playing that F chord, which is you have to bar two strings at once, and it feels like you're wrenching your wrist and you're doing some permanent damage to your entire spinal column getting it done. And, you know, you do flub it a lot, I think, and it just doesn't sound right. And I think that is true for writing as well, you know, where you are... The more you just practice this motion, though, you get closer. But I think with writing, because there are so many complex things going on with both structure, but also then, like, voice. And to me, you know, with guitar, you can kind of learn to play competently. But with writing, I think that there's something that you're bringing to it that is really uniquely yours. Your vision, the kind of your tone, all that stuff. And that really, there's such a huge spectrum. You know, you can read different books. Some people have this really immediate, engaging style. Some people have this more lyrical. And I think, to me, part of the nice thing about doing it over and over and over again is you start to really find that. And for me, that took a lot of novels. You know, it was like maybe my sixth novel or so, seventh novel. I was like, oh, I kind of feel now I'm sort of finding my comfort zone, this place that I really want to explore. And I think, you know, again, National Novel Writing Month, it is nice because you get that opportunity. It's almost like this kind of like a free masterclass in novel writing where there is no teacher. You're the teacher and the student. But I think that's the way that you learn, you know, is really being out there, committing to a certain word count goal and just really practicing.
As you're talking about this, I was thinking the best analogy of becoming a better writer is becoming a better liver. Liver, not the organ, but the you know, just being on the earth. You're better in your 40s than you were in your 30s, and definitely than you were in your 20s. And just getting to know yourself better is probably the best analogy for getting to know your writing better. Is just time at task and time on the face of the earth, experiencing life and all the crap that goes along with it, right?
I believe it. I absolutely believe it. You know, and that said, though, I think, so National Novel Writing Month has a young writers program where we have kids in K-12 classrooms where we send free curriculum and workbooks and buttons and stickers and stuff. And so, you know, we also, I think that there's a real value in writing your first book when you're in fifth grade or sixth grade and also kind of capturing what's going on in your life then, because that may not be a novel. You know, when you write a novel as a seventh grader, it may not be something that you decide you want to publish, but it will be something that you will treasure for the rest of your life. You know, can you imagine having your seventh grade self, like, reading that novel? And it just sort of, I think it encapsulates the way you're seeing the world and who's around you and the things that are important. And so that's another thing that I do love, this idea of people at all ages. You're getting better at writing. Some of these early books may just live in a drawer, but at the same time, they're just so valuable as creative experiments, but also as just reflections of who you were at that moment.
Right, right. Fictional diary entries. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. Well, your whole book is full of fantastic advice. We've drawn down on our time, but I don't even know where to start with asking you to elaborate on any of the advice. But leave us with one fantastic kernel for all of these writers out there that they can hold on to until next November when everybody signs up who's listening right now.
Well, I would just say to know that you you should do it. That I think if you love reading books, you need to be writing books, and that there is, I just say it's so important to make time for it, that you will never have time to write a novel, but you can always make time to write a novel, and that the rewards from it are just incredible. So make time, have fun, and stockpile a whole lot of coffee.
Chris Beatty, what a huge pleasure. Thank you so much for taking
the
time. Huge fun, huge pleasure. All right, so everybody's going to sign up, and we can find you online. Chris Beatty.
Absolutely, chrisbeatty.com if you have anything, and you can reach me through that site as well.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for taking the time this morning.
Thanks for having me.
That was Chris Beatty. The book No Plot, No Problem is full of writing advice. Even if you are scared to do National Novel Writing Month, I don't know why you would be, or if you need something to inspire you until next November when I know you're going to sign up, No Plot, No Problem is great advice. That's all the time we have for today. Next week's Christmas Eve, so I don't know what we have in store, but it's going to be a fantastic Christmas show, I'm sure. Stay tuned for a little bit of reggae coming up next with Sister Rue. You've listened to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.